As oral Bible translation continues to grow in popularity and influence, it's a good idea to keep learning more about its core component, internalization. So I've asked one of the few experts in the world on this subject to join me and walk us through what internalization is, how it works, and more. Her name is Katie Frost, and she was actually my teacher a long time ago for a workshop on oral drafting that I attended in Dallas. This is the Working for the Word podcast. I'm Andrew Case. Let's go. Katie Frost is an ethno-arts consultant with SIL and a professor at Dallas International University. Her experience in ethno-arts, linguistics, and translation led to her co-founding the Psalms Layer by Layer Project, which we've talked about on this podcast before. So she's a Hebraist and very interested in Hebrew poetry. She's done fieldwork in the Netherlands and the Middle East and is married to Josh, who also serves in Bible translation. And they have a baby girl. To begin the interview, I asked Katie, what is internalization?
If you look at dictionary definitions of this word, internalization, you'll see phrases like incorporating something inside yourself or accepting or absorbing, referring to attitudes, behaviors, or values, or turning things inward. And you'll find this word used in a lot of different disciplines. So like in psychology, they talk about making attitudes or behavior part of your nature. That's internalizing them. Or in economics, they talk about incorporating costs as part of pricing structures. In biology, they talk about materials brought inside a cell membrane. Public speaking, it means knowing your message really well. And sports trainers talk about helping their athletes move from head knowledge to automatized physical actions. So all of these have the idea of getting and keeping something inside a person or a system. And likewise, when it comes to internalization of scripture, which is what we're talking about today, we're talking about getting God's word inside of us in a way that it becomes part of us, part of our personal experience. It's something that's often done in oral storying or oral Bible translation projects so that people know the scripture passages well enough to translate them both accurately and naturally into other languages.
That is definitely the best definition I've ever heard of internalization. So how is this different? Because I think a lot of people have a hard time distinguishing that from memorization. So how are those things different?
Yeah, that's a question I get a lot. And it's quite similar, and it actually draws on many of the same techniques as memorization. But there is one really important key difference. When you memorize, you're going for the exact words. So you're thinking of the exact sounds, word forms, word order. But when you internalize, you're trying to get the concepts inside of you in such a way that you can re-express them in a new context. So you're actually going for understanding the semantic and the pragmatic effects of the original material. So you can reconstruct those same functions in another context. So just to make this practical, when you memorize, forgetting the next word can throw you off. You've learned the material based on the exact sound and word combinations, and if you forget what comes next, you don't know how to keep going. I think most of us have experienced this with memorizing Bible verses. But with internalization, a small blip in memory doesn't stop you from carrying on with the other concepts in the passage. When you've internalized something, you're even able to change the words or the sentence order or other factors as needed. So for example, you might change the register of what you've learned because you want to use simpler words to explain it to a little child. Or, as in the case of Bible translation, what we're talking about primarily today, you might be able to express it in a completely different language, but mapping the semantic and pragmatic functions. So a lot of it comes down to understanding, right? Mm-hmm. You can memorize something without understanding much of it at all. Mm-hmm. You can also memorize something and come to understand it very deeply. And that's where you start approaching internalization. Because internalization means that you understand it on these two levels. Like I said, the semantics, the meaning of the words, but you also understand the other effects intended by the passage, the pragmatics. So like how a certain word order might be intended to emphasize a specific concept. Mm-hmm. So that's what allows you to reproduce it in another language. And before we keep going, I have to credit my student, Rhett Parker. Mm-hmm. He was a student of mine in the class at Dallas International University, which I'll call DIU for the rest of the podcast. He helped me pinpoint how understanding the semantics and pragmatics is really the key difference between memorizing and internalizing.
Mm. So how do you internalize something? The steps to making that happen as opposed to memorization? And so could you walk us through that?
Sure. Yeah, the way I like to explain it, I talk about the three E's. So you start with exposure, which is getting an idea of the big picture. And then you move to the second E, experience, where you involve your senses and your intellect in some other ways. And then you also need, very importantly, the third E, which is engagement, where you connect with the material in a personal way that engages your emotions. So basically, we're following a principle that has been used in education for a long time, whole, part, whole. Mm-hmm. You start with the big picture, so you're hooking the new material into things you already know. That's the exposure part. You might talk about the people or the places in the story or identify and talk about new vocabulary. You're just getting used to the whole thing, the thing as a whole. And then you look at the details while you experience it with your senses. And that's the experience part. So maybe you act it out or use hand motions or draw pictures or find random objects from your environment. And this helps you make associations with your senses with the material. Mm. And so that's the parts. And then you come back out to the big picture and you integrate what you've been learning into your own emotional and thought patterns. And that's the engagement part. And there's a lot of research out there that emotionally engaging experiences actually, get this, they release the hormones necessary to remember new things.
Wow.
So emotions actually increase our ability to pay attention.
Mm.
And so that's how I got to the three E's, exposure, experience, and engagement.
Well, that's something that I think every educator should be well aware of. Very helpful.
Yeah. So can I give you a really brief example? What I'd really like to do is put you on the spot and walk you through internalizing something so you can experience it in action. And then our listeners can also experience it for themselves.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Okay. So this little section, and it's a very little section that we're going to do, is from an Old Testament prophet named Isaiah. It's a verse from the middle of a revelation from the Lord. He's basically being commissioned by God to take a message to his own community, but God gives him some very, very difficult instructions. So while I share these instructions with you, I want you to, first of all, listen for the different parts of the human body that God talks to him about.
Okay.
So just listen and notice. So here's the word of the Lord to Isaiah. Harden the hearts of these people. Plug their ears and shut their eyes. That way they will not see with their eyes, nor hear with their ears, nor understand with their hearts, and turn to me for healing. Okay, so did you hear some different parts of the human body there?
Yeah. Hearts, ears, eyes.
Great. So this time I'm going to give you the word of the Lord again, and I'd like you to point to the parts on your body that God is talking about while I go through the text.
Okay.
Here's the word of the Lord. Harden the hearts of these people, plug their ears, and shut their eyes. That way they will not see with their eyes, nor hear with their ears, nor understand with their hearts, and turn to me for healing.
It's a nice chiastic structure.
Oh, you're ahead of me. That's great. We're going to come back to that in just a second.
Okay.
I'd like to do it a third time. Mm-hmm. And this time I'd like you to act out the action that goes with each part of your body.
Okay.
So show what it looks like to harden hearts and plug ears and so forth.
Okay.
So here it is again. Harden the hearts of these people, plug their ears, and shut their eyes. That way they will not see with their eyes, nor hear with their ears, nor understand with their hearts, and turn to me for healing.
Got it.
Okay, now you noticed the pattern already.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you saw or heard.
Well, I saw hearts first, then ears, then eyes, ears, heart pattern.
Yes. So if you hadn't already said to me, I've heard the chiasm, I probably would have given it to you one more time just to be sure that you could. And I would have asked you to listen for the order.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully the way you were pointing to the parts of your body and interacting with them, you would notice, hey, I'm pointing to the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. And you could figure out what the pattern was that way.
Yeah.
So I'll give it to you one more time, and then I'm going to ask you to give it back to me. So do the motions again, just to help get it embodied.
Okay.
So here's the verse one more time. Harden the hearts of these people, plug their ears and shut their eyes. That way they will not see with their eyes, nor hear with their ears, nor understand with their hearts, and turn to me for healing. So now go ahead and try to say it back to me. Yep.
Harden the hearts of these people, plug their ears and shut their eyes. That way they will not be able to see with their eyes, or hear with their ears, or understand with their hearts, and turn to me.
Great. Great. Now, let's talk about what you did, because it brings out some really cool examples of what internalization does. So you were word for word for parts of it, and that's perfectly fine, especially when you're first learning, you're going to tend to give back what I gave you, because
right.
That's how you learned it. Now, if you did this again tomorrow, you might have shifted more of the words around to be a little bit more of your idiolect, right?
Yep.
How you normally speak and how you normally process.
Mm-hmm.
But already you did a couple of things that were slightly different, and I think they're really great examples. For example, I gave you, that way they will not see with their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, that way they will not be able to see with their eyes.
Okay.
Right? You haven't functionally changed anything,
mm-hmm.
but you've expressed it in a way that makes sense to you and that works really well for you. And in the version I gave you, I said, nor hear with their ears, nor understand, and you used or, which is a normal way to speak in English and probably more natural than the version I gave you, right?
Yeah.
So you can see already how even in a little example like this, it's already becoming more natural for you the way you're talking. And that's the goal in oral Bible translation, is that it gets expressed in a way that's natural for the people who are translating.
Right. Yeah, and you gave it to me already in a very, I guess, comparatively to something like a really formal equivalent version, pretty natural. I don't know if that's like the NLT or something. Even as natural as it already was, that's a really good example. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just fun how that happens. And then over time, you would continue modifying it slightly if it needed to be. So I would like to talk about review, but before we do, let's just reflect quickly on this process that we did, just to review the three E's.
Yeah.
So I started out with a little bit of context. That's the exposure part. And since this is a demo, I kept it really short. But in a normal extended situation, we would have listened to the whole chapter, or at least part of it. I would have made sure you knew who Isaiah was, what his role was as a prophet, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And for this demo, knowing you a little bit and knowing that you're biblically literate, I could make this much briefer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then for experience, I had you engage with your body. So listening for the body parts that are mentioned, pointing to them, acting out the actions associated with them. And that was the part I really wanted you and our listeners to experience, is, no pun intended, the experience part of
yep.
internalization. And then what we also didn't really do, but would come next in a longer, if we had more time, would be engagement. So I did ask you to think about the patterns, and being aware of a concentric structure like this would help you or a translation team remember not just this verse, right? But also there are a lot of chiasms, concentric structures in the Psalms and other poetry. But we could have done a lot of other things. Like I could have asked you, does anything about this passage surprise you? What touches you? What disturbs you? We could get into more devotional, how does this apply to your life? Who might you tell this about? The discipleship, the discovery Bible questions
sure.
are really helpful for engagement as well.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those disturbing passages.
Yeah, really, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll just mention for the people who are listening, what I did as far as hand motions and stuff, so to represent the hardening of my heart, I just put a fist, like a hard fist, over my heart, and then I covered my ears with both hands, covered my eyes with both hands, and then I used my fingers to open my eyes to see, and then I kind of cupped my ears to hear, and then I kind of did a sort of an unfolding motion above my heart to symbolize understanding with my heart. So I don't know, Katie, how would you symbolize understanding your heart with your heart?
That's a difficult one. Something that shows opening is great. Yes, and I think when you got to the end, actually, you said, and turn to me, but there was a little piece that there's a reason why we turn to the Lord. And I forgot to come back to that and ask you. So that's turn to
I
me
left
for
it
healing.
Out, didn't I?
You
right,
did. And
for
what's
healing.
Important.
Yeah.
And what's important about that is when you're internalizing, you need somebody who is checking the original and can make sure that important information is not being left out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is an important part of this process and the role I was taking in this. Yeah, in terms of, thank you for describing the motions that you did. And one of the other educational principles involved in internalization is that when you engage with thinking of your own prompts, you are already learning the material just by being creative that way. So there are some internalization practices that give people motions, and that's okay in certain contexts. But if you have the opportunity and it works in your context for people to come up with their own motions, it will engage them even more. So that's really mm-hmm. helpful.
And I just want to emphasize too, for everyone who's listening, that doing this, every time that I've done it, it's just fun to do. I don't know. It really feels like you're bringing things to life in a different way. And it just feels so much more refreshing and engaging than staring at a screen of text. So, yeah.
And there's actually a lot of research also coming out in the last few years about something called embodied cognition, which is that when we move our bodies and engage our bodies, then we learn better, we learn more deeply, we learn more thoroughly, we learn yeah. in different ways. So there are a lot of reasons you don't have to do motions. You can draw pictures, you can use random objects like I mentioned, you can do things like a memory palace where you're associating things more internally. There are a lot of things you can do in this experience stage, but moving your body is highly recommended as at least one of the things that you do in the process.
Yeah. And it's something that I wish I got to experience more often with translation teams, because it really is a joy to kind of do this together. Have we talked enough about review, or are there some things about review that we haven't mentioned yet?
No, I'd really like to talk about review, because review is one of the things that is probably the most discouraging for people who are trying to do memorization. Many of us have histories of memorizing scripture and then feeling very sad that a few years later we can't remember it anymore. And that can creep into internalization then as well, is you can work really hard by yourself or with a team and you get something internalized and then it's gone when you need to revise it. So repetition is, of course, the answer everyone gives, but that's also can be discouraging because how much is enough repetition? So I think it's important to talk about the science of memory gives us a few clues on how to make the most of our initial exposure to the material. And for that, I usually give people three numbers, 20, 2, and 24. So review it after 20 minutes, after 2 hours, and after 24 hours. 20 minutes keeps it active in your short-term memory. So you get it into your short-term memory when you first are exposed to it, and then if you review it again within 20 minutes, it keeps it there rather than just flying out with all the other input we get all day long that we don't need to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a culture that doesn't watch clocks, you can say review it after one other short task that you've done. So then after the 20 minutes or the short task, then you need to review it within another 2 to 3 hours to reactivate it again and keep it in the short-term memory, and it gets a little bit deeper into it, right? So in less time-oriented contexts, I might say do this after a little bit more longer complex task, but make sure you do it before your next meal or do it the same day. And then if you catch it again 24 hours later, that is around the same time next day, right? It will start moving into your longer term memory. So those three those three mileposts are very important. The 20 minutes, the 2 hours, the 24 hours. So I have this little saying 20 to 24. And then from there, everyone is different. And you'll probably need to keep reviewing it every 24 hours or so for a while to keep it activated until it moves into longer term memory. But once it's in longer term memory, you can move to reviewing it only every few weeks or even every few months after a while. So I've had examples where I've pulled things out that I haven't done for 6 or 9 months, but they were learned so well a few years ago that they're still in there.
Hmm. Awesome. So here's something. How did you get involved personally with internalization? So I would love to hear your background story for this.
Yeah, my journey with all of this happened about 7 years ago when Heather Beal, who is the course head for oral translation at DIU, asked me if I'd be willing to help with a demo of internalization for her class. And as we started talking about it, we quickly realized that we didn't just need a demo, but we also needed a system for teaching people how to internalize, because we're training people to go work with other people and to teach other people. And so we needed something that was reproducible. So in working out the details for that, I actually drew from three primary sources, which I think is so much fun, just how God leads our lives and things work together. So first, I was drawing from what's being done in the field with internalization. So at that time, when I first started, most of the best practices were being passed on primarily by word of mouth, and they were being honed through different people's experiences in different contexts. So obviously, I needed to draw and learn from what was being done.
And this is in within mission organizations, kind of word of mouth?
Yeah. So, okay. I can mention some of these later, but you have like Jim and Janet Stahl had been doing a lot with storying. You had Seed Company, who was getting up a whole program on training people in oral strategies. You had the IMB busy and had been doing this for a while. So these kinds of organizations. Then I added to that the memory techniques that I'd learned and practiced through 5 years of organ performance studies when I was in college and grad school. And it was there that I learned a lot about how our brains work, how we learn information, how we retain and review, and also all the different techniques that you can use to help yourself focus on the information that you need to focus on. And then third, I was drawing from my experiences and studies in education, especially exposure to adult learning principles like those from Jane Vella or Learning That Lasts. So I got to put all of those things together to develop a system. And then, of course, over the years, it's been refined as we've learned what works best and what speaks best to people. But since then, I just keep adding and learning whenever I encounter things that might be helpful. So recently, my husband, Josh, has been studying how we might handle emotions for developing exegetical resources for translation. And in the process, he's found some really, really interesting articles about how emotions are connected with learning. So that's opened up the whole world of what I mentioned already about that third E, engagement, why that's so important, and has given me access to the science about how emotions seem to be directly involved with learning and memory. And I also mentioned embodied cognition and how much more effectively we learn when we involve our bodies. And you mentioned internalization being fun. There's some fascinating research out there by someone named Ferreira who published in 2021 on collaborative learning and how working in groups lightens everyone's cognitive load. So it's not only more fun, but it's actually easier. And it's even easier when groups use gestures and this embodied cognition idea for collaborative learning. So yes, I've just been enjoying this for the last 7 years, keep building on it whenever I have the opportunity.
Awesome. So this is something I've been wondering about, is this the whole history behind the idea of internalization, how it got started as a field of study in general. Could you mention some things that have contributed to that or where it began?
Sure, I'll do my best. It is a very new field, and I actually was reading in Chris Toler. So Chris Toler took our oral Bible translation class at DIU a few years ago. And I'll probably talk about him a little bit later and tell a great story about him. But he wrote his master's thesis on internalization. And he gives a good history, a brief history of the modern oral Bible storying and translation movement. So he starts it in the 1960s when New Tribes Mission worked in the Philippines with chronological Bible storytelling. And then other ministries picked that up over the decades and started exploring oral Bible translation. And then Robin Green in 2007 proposed that a full oral Bible translation should be possible. And as people embraced that idea and oral Bible translation became more widely accepted, internalization suddenly needed to be taken care of because somehow the mother tongue translators needed access to a source text, but in completely oral context, they weren't able to read to get that access. So if I understand the field correctly, everyone started trying to figure out how to do internalization. And the practice has grown over the years with a lot of people working in parallel in different contexts. And it seems like I was invited to get involved kind of in the thick of things around the time people were starting to produce documentation and trying to codify things. So by this point, most ministries have recommendations for best practices. So you have Seed Company with doing trainings on the field. Jim and Janet Stahl published a handbook on oral Bible storying in 2019. Brian Kelly wrote an article in 2018 outlining the oral drafting process, in which he also talks about internalization. We train people in our course at DIU. Spoken has their trainers and preferences for how they handle internalization, and so on. And so what you end up with is many approaches that are very, very similar and have a great amount of overlap. And what I find so interesting about internalization is that it's called for in such a wide variety of contexts that it needs to be very, very adaptable. But we also need to teach people how to do it. So in one of my presentations for the Seed Company Orality Landscape of Practice, I identified 12 different factors that shift from context to context and could make a big difference in how you do internalization. So things like the size of the team, cultural preferences for learning, whether exegesis is done beforehand by a facilitator or together during internalization by a team, and so on. And when I presented this, then I asked the audience, I said, well, what other factors can you think of? And they added 5 more that I hadn't thought of. So that's a total of at least 17 major factors that are different in different contexts where we're trying to do internalization. So my goal has been to develop a framework that gives us the basics but can still easily be adapted in any context. And so far, the 3 E's have been working well for that goal.
Mm-hmm. Now, does this process, this strategy, work for any kind of scripture? Probably a lot of people are wondering, can you do it with Paul's letters, for example, which are even more complex than a narrative?
Yes. So this is one of the most fascinating questions to me, actually, about internalization, because people are generally intimidated by internalizing poetry or other non-narrative passages like the epistles. The principles for both non-narrative and narrative are the same, and they work just as well. So you still start with exposure, help people get used to the new vocabulary, the major themes, the overall flow of thought. And then it's just as important as ever to connect each detail well with the senses at the experience stage, because you need each thought unit to have a special association long enough to get it inside of you. And then you still need to engage really deeply, cognitively and emotionally, to retain the material. But it's right there, engaging deeply, cognitively and emotionally, that I actually think is the reason why non-narrative feels so much harder. Because first of all, we don't always understand it as well, and then we don't always connect with it emotionally as well. Mm-hmm. So given what I said already about how emotions help us learn and remember things, I'm not sure which of these comes first, the not understanding or the not connecting. But somehow these two things happen. With narrative, we know the logic of stories. We expect some kind of conflict, we expect tension that builds to a climax, and then we expect some level of resolution. But with non-narrative, the logic of the argument is not always as clear. So in poetry, for example, we may struggle to understand what's happening. And in Paul's epistles, we might struggle with what is he trying to say and how is he building his argument. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why I'm so excited about the Psalms Layer by Layer project that I'm involved in, because we're trying to find that inner logic of the poems so other people don't have to spend all this extra time trying to understand what's happening. And I think that will make internalization much, much easier. But in cases that those kinds of materials aren't available, it's just on the facilitator to help a group understand and connect emotionally. And that takes more preparation ahead of time. It might take the group a little bit more time to connect. And so overall, it probably feels harder. Mm-hmm. If the group, though, can understand and they can connect emotionally, and you can use the three E's, exposure, engagement, and experience, internalization, in theory, works just as well for non-narrative passages. And in practice, I have seen this over and over. In fact, I teach Psalm 67 every year in our course. And I see every year people internalize that 7-verse psalm in less than an hour and then go on to draft really, really effective translations of it. So I know it can work, but it needs the right kind of understanding and ability to connect emotionally. And I would love to share two stories, both from my experience, but one on the field and one right in our classroom. So the one on the field is from Chris Toller, who I mentioned earlier. So he took the Oral Bible Translation course from us a few years ago, and he was really skeptical of internalization initially. And he'll tell you this. I was not just imagining this as a teacher. He was definitely not sure.
Yeah, he talks about it in his master's thesis. So, yeah.
Yes. And somehow we inspired him enough to at least try it, because he introduced it to his team of Central Palme translators in Mexico. And they weren't completely sure about it either. But after they tried it, they said, "We're never going back to the old way. We absolutely only want to do it this way." And they were so successful and have continued to be so successful that Chris ended up writing his master's thesis on internalization and their experiences.
Yeah.
So I just love, that's one of my favorite field stories. Yeah. My other favorite story that happened in our classroom was a couple of years ago, we had a student from Brazil. And we had asked the students to internalize Psalm 67, as I mentioned, we do every year, and make an artistic rendition of it. And on a whim, I asked Josue, the student from Brazil, if after internalizing the psalm in English, he thought he could express it in Portuguese. And I will absolutely never forget that moment, because he paused for about half a minute, and then he looked up at the ceiling, and then he started talking. And the psalm just started spilling out without any hesitation. And my colleague Heather was able to track enough of the language to tell that he was getting everything. And then he stopped. And apparently he was just as amazed as we were. And I kept asking him questions like, "How well did you know the psalm in Portuguese? Have you ever memorized that before? Did you just use the words of a version you already knew or heard?" And he said, No, I don't know. That just happened. And he was basically able to reproduce Psalm 67 in his first language because he had internalized the psalm so well, even in a second language, in English.
Awesome.
So I was just so encouraged by that. It just happened right in front of our eyes.
Sweet. That's great. We've talked about success stories. Do you have any cautions for people getting into internalization?
Yeah, so I would absolutely encourage people to use internalization as much as they can, hiding the word in their hearts in this way, super effective in our personal devotional lives, but also in translation contexts. But I would add the very large caution that you can only internalize as well as you understand the passage.
Right.
So that means that you need really good exegesis as a foundation. And what that means is taking the time to do the study required, or to find someone who is willing to answer your questions, or to check you to make sure that you're staying accurate with your understanding as you go through internalization. And that comes with a related caution that you can't skimp on internalization if you're going to draft a translation, because you'll only be able to draft well what you've internalized well. Mm-hmm. So you can think of it kind of like a two-story house. You need a really, really solid foundation of exegesis to hold that first floor of internalization. But the first floor also needs to be sturdy enough to support the second floor of drafting a translation. So if the foundation is lacking, the first floor is going to cave in certain spots. And if the foundation is fine, but the first floor is lacking, then the second floor is going to cave in right at those same spots. So the big caution just being, take the time that's required to make sure it's staying accurate and you're truly coming to a good understanding rather than just some understanding, which may not be accurate anymore.
Mm-hmm. Good word. Now, you mentioned oral contexts already for internalization, but is there any reason to do internalization for written context or written translations? For those who have been following this podcast, this should be an easy answer, an obvious answer, but I'd love to hear you talk about this.
Sure. I mean, yes, I believe there are reasons, and also lots of people are doing it. Lots and lots of written contexts have found great success with internalizing and then orally drafting. And people like it because it usually results in more natural speech patterns and expressions. It's a lot easier to adjust some words slightly than to take something really wooden and try to make it flow more smoothly. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, when someone has internalized a whole passage, it helps tremendously with the overall flow. And I would argue that some of the biggest gains are on the discourse level. So just as an example, different languages introduce and then reference characters and stories in different ways. So if you don't use a specific language's conventions, it can throw off the naturalness and sometimes result in really serious miscommunications. And a great example comes from my colleague Megan Smith, who worked with a Suri team in Ethiopia. And in Suri, if you present a proper name a second time in a text, it means it's a brand new character, someone new but having the same name. Hmm. So in Genesis 1, if you say, "God said, let there be light," and a few verses later, "God said, let there be a divide between waters," and a few verses later, "God said, let the waters be gathered to one place," then the Suri people would think that there are three different characters at play here, and each is named God.
Yeah.
So you end up with three different gods in the span of just a few verses. And if you're just translating the text without the full story internalized, you might miss this and end up with a serious problem. But if you learn the whole story before translating and you're speaking it out and you're checking it with other people, you're going to identify that issue, you're going to be able to talk through it, and then use the appropriate conventions to reference God each time. So any discourse factors like that, participant reference, verb forms, connectors, ways of moving a narrative forward, all of these kinds of things benefit from internalization of the whole passage prior to drafting. And I would also argue that it may seem like it would take longer, but the short-term cost in time is likely to result in a long-term gain in terms of naturalness and ultimately the fidelity of communication.
Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, these are teams, we're talking about teams that may not necessarily be producing an oral recording of this, but they're just doing a written translation, but for the sake of getting that natural feel to it, they do internalization processes and oral processes and oral drafting to benefit their written translation. So
yes, that's exactly right. Yep.
Or some teams do both at the same time. So yeah, either way. So where can we learn, if we want to go deeper into this whole issue, where can we learn more about internalization? Have there been any dissertations written on this, any books published, et cetera?
Yeah, so there are some exciting things in process. As I mentioned, the field is still pretty new, so we're still waiting for that definitive definitive work on internalization. But I'd love to mention a few things. I've mentioned a few already. I'll recap some of those. But give you a few new ones as well. So a couple named Tricia and Steven Stringer have actually been commissioned to create internalization guides for every passage of scripture. And they've started with the book of Mark and are already close to finishing that one and are moving on to the next one. So that's a very exciting initiative. With the Psalms Layer by Layer project, as I already mentioned, we're producing overview videos to help people understand the Psalms better. And we're also developing specific internalization materials, which we'll make available when we have them ready. I also mentioned Jim and Janet Stahl have written an oral Bible storytelling handbook. It was published in 2019, and that includes ideas and resources for doing internalization. We teach the Oral Bible Translation course at DIU, which I highly recommend for anyone wanting to get into the field more deeply.
Sorry, is that course a semester-long course? Is it a brief course?
Yeah, the Oral Bible Translation course at DIU is sometimes a semester course and sometimes a summer course. Okay. And the summer course is just 9 weeks long. You meet every day for an hour on the last schedule. I'm not sure what it will be this next summer, but...
Cool.
Yeah, and then I already mentioned Chris Toller's master's thesis at DIU, which is all about internalization and his experiences with Central Pame in Mexico. And I'll also send you a couple of links that you can post with this podcast if you want to two presentations and handouts that I've done on internalization for Seed Company. They have the Orality Landscape of Practice. And I did one that focuses specifically on non-narrative internalization. And the other one talks in general how to prepare for and facilitate internalization. That's the one that gets into all the different factors involved.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to enlighten us in so many ways and help us work through some more detail on this whole issue. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.